Welcome to episode 460 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview Dr. Guido Vroomen. Guido is a Dutch coach and sports medicine physician, and today we have a classic training talk episode with lots of details, insights, and advice for application in your own training. Before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and chews that are effective, practical, and tasty. And of course, they also make electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your set sodium concentration. Their products make it easy for you to execute your nutrition and hydration plan in both training and racing, as they are tasty, have practical packaging, and use simple round numbers so you don't have to do mental math when redlining in a race. They have a free fuel and hydration planner, free consultations with sports scientists, a massive database of case studies, and lots of in-depth and well-researched articles that will give you everything from the basics to the finer nuances of nutrition and hydration. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Guido Vroomen. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Guido. How are you doing?
Thank you for your invitation. I'm pretty good now. Yes, thanks.
Where are you based? Are you in the Netherlands currently?
Yes, based in the Netherlands, in Amersfoort. And that's, it's about 20 kilometers above Utrecht and let's say 50 kilometers east of Amsterdam. So right in the middle.
Yeah, I've actually been to Utrecht. I really liked it. It's a nice town. Let's maybe start with a bit of an introduction to yourself, if you can tell us more about your background in endurance sports.
Yeah. I started studying in Utrecht, and that's a long time ago. It's 1988. I was interested in medical biology. It was called then. Nowadays, it's biomedical sciences. I started to study that with a special interest in exercise physiology. Did some research on that. Also, another research in molecular biology. So that's really the scientific base of my study. But during that study, I didn't want to end up just in a lab. I also wanted to work with athletes and help them to become better. So then the study of medicine came into my view, and the first 2 years of medical biology and medicine in Utrecht are pretty similar. So I, but the first, it's not an open study, so I had to get in the study of medicine, which didn't succeed in the first year. So I just went on with medical biology. And in my fourth year, I got also in medicine. So I started medicine, finished medical biology, but went on with medicine just because I wanted to become doctor in sports medicine and exercise physiology. I succeeded in that after finishing medicine in 97. Then I started a four-year time for getting sports medicine and exercise physiology doctor. And that was 2003. Then I finished. So that's a long time for studying. and then you start, you have to start working. But I didn't really find the place where I could do what I wanted. So what do you do then? Well, you start your own business, and that was really small. It was in a health and sports center, and I started there as a sports doctor, just an afternoon in the week. So that was nothing, but it grew and grew, and it got bigger, and it was successful. And let's say in 5-6 years, it was a sports medicine practice. With one colleague of mine, we did that very good there. It was big fun, specialized in endurance sports. So we did mostly runners, cyclists, and triathletes. and that went on and get bigger. And in 2011, we moved to here in the city of Amersfoort because we had a I had an opportunity to join the University of Physiotherapy, and I lectured there exercise physiology. And then it also got bigger because Amersfoort is a big town, so many athletes found the way to me for exercise testing, injury consultancy. But it got too big because I also started, let's say, in 2010-11 to become trainer coach, because that was my passion. At the end of, it was 2019, 2020, I got lots of athletes that I train and coach. That's 40, 50 people. A big sports medicine practice. So that were two jobs. That was too much. And my wife was manager of the sports medicine practice. But it wasn't that there was so much hassle about certifications and stress of people that you have people that work for you and they got sick, and we had to find a solution for that. So we looked for somebody that would take over this, and we found a good person. So now I still work in the same sports medicine center, but only one day, and the other days in the week I'm full-time trainer coach of the athletes of triathletes, mountain bikers, cyclists, runners. And that's a lot of fun. And we're now 5 years later, and I'm really happy in what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's great. And so it sounds like from pretty early on, you knew that you wanted to work with athletes, but did you already know then that you wanted to be a coach? Or was that something that happened a bit later, after having spent some time practicing sports medicine?
Yeah, that happened later on the way to, the first 10 years I was just sports medicine doctor. One of the things was the exercise testing and the prescription of zones and how to become better, and not that much the injury side. So from the exercise physiology side, I started to train myself, get educated in being a trainer, coach, certification from the triathlon union, and I liked it very much. So that's why I kept on going with that, and my athletes were pretty happy and satisfied with me. So I think there's something good in this.
Yeah. And quickly on that sports medicine practice still, when you're practicing as a sports medicine physician, what were the most common things that people came to you for? Do you know, have a list of
overload injuries? So many are endurance sports. So many injuries are come from running. Running is the most injury-prone sports that there is. So it's always ligaments, Achilles, knee injuries, foot injuries. That's the biggest group of injuries to treat, and it's not that often that you have to refer to a surgeon or an orthopedic. Sometimes it is, because then it's really fucked up. Then it's really damaged. But most of the time, you have to prescribe different training sessions. So if there's a really a running injury that needs to stop running, you have to prescribe, maybe you can better do now cycling, or you can better do swimming or strength training. So that was the biggest group to treat.
And do you have some advice that you would say for preventing to have overload injuries?
Yeah. Listen to your body. That's always a very wise But that's very hard for every athlete because, well, it's difficult to differentiate between is something a pain or is it becoming an injury? Is it just a little pain that will heal tomorrow or the day after tomorrow and then it's okay again? Or is it staying there for days, becoming worse, becoming even more painful, and then it's not going away anymore, and then you have an injury. So that's a balance which really is very difficult for athletes because, well, they always try to ignore the pain, and they think, well, if I'm warmed up quite good, I don't feel anything, but then the next day when I get up, it's stiff and it's painful. So that's, yeah, it's difficult.
Yeah, I think if you have, for me, one rule that I tell my athletes is maybe if you have 2 days in a row, you have some pain, then that's a yellow flag. Then for sure, tell me. Ideally, tell me the first day, but at least the second day, it's a yellow flag. And if it's 3 days in a row, that's a bit of a red flag. And then it doesn't mean that, then it, at least it means that we have to think about it. Does it mean that we take a few days off or running, for example, or is it a bit worse? You need to maybe see somebody. So that's a kind of a simple rule that I try to.
Yeah,
to
I think that's a very good rule. I tell all my athletes to tell me everything, how the training went. And if they have some pain feelings, it's not normal. Then I can decide what to do with it. And that's what I have in favor of just a trainer coach that isn't a doctor. I can make a better decision if something is just normal and we can proceed or not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think the main part or the bulk of this interview will be about the coaching side of things, but it was really interesting to hear about the medicine background. But let's get the most difficult question out of the way first. So can you discuss your coaching methodology?
Yeah, okay. I want to know how the athlete, how his performance system is built. So I always want to take a look at the energy systems. How good are your energy systems? How good is your aerobic system? Is it well developed? Is it strong enough? How good is your anaerobic system? Is it necessary to have a very strong anaerobic lactate system? How good is your sprint system? And what are your goals? What races do you want to do? And what is needed for those races? If the races are, well, let's say a long distance triathlon, we don't have to bother about the sprint system because that's not a race where you have to sprint. The big thing is the aerobic system. But I never forget the anaerobic system because it's, in my opinion, it's very important to stay, to have a good anaerobic system. And I will. Almost every week, I have pretty high intensity intervals for every athlete, even the long distance triathlete. So, in my opinion, every energy system needs to be trained. Not every system trained as much as the other, but every system needs to be trained because they affect each other. In the beginning, when I have a new athlete, it's just a matter of the first week getting to know each other. How good is an athlete? How does he understand what I mean with training sessions? And then in the next weeks, I am going to put some tests in the training sessions. So I train with power. And power is very important for me. Because it says something about energy. How much energy can you produce per time? Now, if you can produce more energy per time, you can produce more power, mechanical power, and that will make you faster, stronger. And in the power duration curve, I want to see how the power develops. So it's a 2 minute, it's a 5 minute value, best value, your 10 minute, your 20, your 40, your 60. And some of those are weak and some of those are strong. And you see some have a really high 2 minute, but they decrease very fast in the 5 minute and the 10 minute. And other people don't have much anaerobic power, and the 2 and the 5, it's a very slow decrease. So power, and that's not only in cycling, but also in running, is very important to me. And I try to make athletes as efficient as possible with that, and building a big, strong engine.
When you say that that you also train the anaerobic system for even for long distance triathletes, can you talk a bit more about why do they need to train the anaerobic system? What is the reason for it?
Yeah, well, if you do a long distance triathlon, it's not always a course that's just totally flat. Well, here in the Netherlands, we have a long distance triathlon in Almere. Well, that's totally flat. You have to go up a dike, it's 5 meters, but that's it. So that's a really constant power then. But many races do have hills, they do have climbs. And if you want to compete at your best, you don't want to push your pedals on the flat just in a steady state pace. And then when there comes a hill, you can shift back to the lowest gear and then just slowly pedal up the mountain because you don't have any anaerobic power to push the pedals and go fast up. You have some surges always in races. Maybe you want to race and pick up or get after somebody, and also in the run. So there's always... It's not like cycling, when somebody sprints away and then you go behind after him. But also, you have to have some anaerobic tank, which can help you recover faster.
And do you think that this is? Do you use the same philosophy with age groupers and professional athletes? Because for some age groupers, maybe they need to be a bit more conservative when they do an Ironman. So is it equally important or?
No. Well, the professionals, it's racing. And that's really fast. So you have to be prepared. And sometimes you have to close a gap because you lost too many time in the swim. So you have to close a gap on the bike, or you lost too much on the bike and you have to close a gap in the run. You have to have some anaerobic capacity to do that. With age groupers, it can be also this point, but most of them are they're just busy with their own race, and it's just conservative. Well, this is my power. I have this much to spend. If I go too long over it, I will have to pay it back, one way or the other. So stay to the plan and don't burn up too many matches above it. So then the good finish is more important than the race dynamics.
Yeah. Maybe let's go into some principles within each discipline that you have, or principles or some typical features of how you plan the, let's start with the swim training. What are some principles there?
Well, the swim training technique is always the most important thing, and I'm not a very good swim trainer, so I work with people that I know that are very good swim trainers. If athletes are not good with their technique and they can improve a lot with that, I'll send them to those technique trainers, and they have to learn a better technique. So that will win seconds already. Another thing in swimming is don't swim always in a swimming pool, because you have to train also in open water, especially the age. I know some age groupers that are very good swimmers, but then they had to swim in open water, which was cold, which was dark, which was choppy, and they were so afraid. They started hyperventilating. So that's something you really don't want in a race. So you have to train that also. Open water swim is really crucial to be there very comfortable in. And the tempo training sets is just working with critical swim speed, and then doing the swim speed sessions, just the 50 meters, just a little bit faster than your critical swim speed, your 100 meters, your 200 meters, etc. That's what I use in the swim.
Yeah. Can you give a couple of example of the sessions? So one with shorter intervals, faster than critical speed, and one that is maybe right at critical speed that you would typically use.
Yeah, well, the 50 meters, I let them swim in 105, 110% of the critical swim speed. And then depending on how fast they are, giving them, 10 to 15 seconds rest for the next 50 meters. So it's a short rest. And then again, the 100 meters will be 100 to 105%. And the 200 and the 400 meters will be 95-100%, like in pace, sort of like that.
And how much volume would you be doing in the main set?
It's about an hour, so depending on the critical swim speed, it will be between 3 and 4 kilometers.
All right. Yeah. Was there anything else on swimming, or do you want to move on to biking?
Yeah, that's my favorite.
All right, so let's do it. What are your bike training principles?
Yeah, well, you have to have a power meter, as I told. I can do a lot with the data from a power meter. First, I forgot to mention, when I start with an athlete, I always do a lab test to start, unless I have a lot of data from history of the athlete that I can go through, and I can really see what the level right now is about critical power. If I don't have that, then I want a lab test, and I do a CPET in the lab, and I detect the VT1, the VT2, and see how the energy systems of the athlete are. So then I have my zones, aerobic zones, aerobic, anaerobic, steady state zones, critical power, VO2 max, and I try to I try to make some interval training sessions that what I think are really hard for the athlete, and see if that works for the athlete, if they can fulfill that. VO2 max training sessions. Normally, you do that with 2-3-4 minute sessions at, let's say, 110-120%. Well, sometimes I do also shorter sessions, like a minute at 120%, but then I give 15 seconds easy pedaling, and I let them do that 5 or 6 times behind each other. So you have a really short recovery, and the recovery is not that long that your heart rate goes down, but for your muscle, it's a recovery. It feels very different then. So then it's easier to maintain the high power and the high heart rate. Another thing that I do with cycling, and that many of the athletes don't like, is the torque training. And the torque training, well, that's low cadence training. and it's really some sort of strength training on the bike. And that, I think it's very important to develop strength on the bike, because if you have a lot of strength, especially in the time trial position, you have to push the pedals, and you can't push always above 100 RPM. And with to exaggerate the low cadence, you can develop the strength and may become stronger, and it helps you. After that, you can also see if that strength you developed in the torque training, you can develop that into speed, into higher cadence sprints, for example. So that's more, if I think the athlete can gain in strength on the bike, I give him the torque training.
And what would a typical torque training session look like?
Yeah. Well, that's the technical thing. I want to give a torque. If you have a strong athlete, it's a Newton meter per kilogram, 1.0. Well, you can calculate that, and that I will try to explain it. So it's not power-based, but I can calculate with the 1.0 Newton meter per kilogram. One circumference of a pedal is 2 pi times the radius. So 2 pi is 6.28. If I set the RPM to 60, so we have every second one round, then we have the calculation from minute to seconds, because we have joules per second. That's the watt. That's out. So if we have the weight of the athlete, and let's say the weight is 80 kilograms, we multiply that with the 2 pi. So that's 6.28. So 80 times 6.28, that's just above 500. So that's, if the athlete then cycles 60 RPM, he needs to push the pedals for 500 watts at 60 RPM. And then we start with 1 minute. Seated on the saddle, don't stand, seated on the saddle, on a, well, not a very steep hill, let's say 5% hill. And then for 1 minute, then turn around, go back, roll out to the beginning, and you do that 5 times. And then I will increase that in along the weeks to 2 minutes, 3 minutes, even 4 minutes. And that's a long time if you have to sit on the saddle, push 500 watts with 60 RPM for 4 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot. And so they're sitting up, they're not in the TT position, correct?
Sitting on the saddle, yeah. Okay. Don't have to be in the TT position, no.
Okay. That's really fascinating to hear. And I think the listeners might want to rewind or go to the show notes. We'll have this in the show notes so you can see it easily. Anything else on the bike? Any other important things?
I do also the long distance easy rides, but in the bike, with the intervals, I do also the a combination of, let's say 2 or 3 hours easy ride, and then do the intervals after that. So you have a sort of fatigue build up, and then at the end, you still have to produce the power that is required. Many can do that in the, if you do an interval training, you have a warm up of 15, 30 minutes, and then you can do the intervals. But if I go to a race and it's a long distance triathlon, I want to create also some fatigue and see if you're fatigue resistant. And you can do that also after 2 or 3 hours cycling.
Yeah. And let's move on to the run then, some run training principles.
Yeah. There's again the power, and in the run, I use with many athletes the stride foot power, the footpod power, and I'm looking there for the running economy, but also the running efficiency. So how much power is needed for a certain amount of speed, And that's very different between good runners and bad runners. Well, then you have the same environmental circumstances, so, well, not that much wind and it's just flat. But you can see a lot of things change with very good runners. They are very efficient and they have a low ECOR, as it's called, economy of running.
Energy cost of running.
And that will help you to maintain a certain speed and don't have a lot of energy burned. So that's something I use a lot, the stride, and then I do a lot of interval training sessions, also at critical power, but also at VO2 max, and building up to a race like a half triathlon or long distance triathlon. I also do long blocks at race speed. And also this, after maybe 1 hour or 90 minutes or even 2 hours easy run, you have to do the pace you wanted to do in the race also for 20 or 30 minutes.
Yeah. And can you give some examples on the VO2 max and critical power sessions for the run?
Yeah, the VO2 max is sort of like the bike sessions. It's about, let's say, 2 minutes or 1 minute with a short recovery, but 2-3 minutes at 110-120% of the critical power. And the critical power runs or the threshold runs are just at 100% or maybe a little bit higher, 103-105%. 4, 5, 6, maybe 7, 8 minutes.
Yep. Yeah.
And that depends on, well, the amount of intervals. If you do a full Ironman, it can be up to 10 times a kilometer. So if you do 15 kilometers at a critical speed, it would be 10 times 4 minutes. And in between 2 minutes, just easy dribbling.
Yeah. And when you measure the energy cost, the efficiency of the athlete, does that go up naturally over time with volume, with interval training, or do you have something specific that you do to try to improve the efficiency of athletes?
It's a very difficult thing to improve because it's really in the way of running. Well, the advantage also of stride is that you can see many, many data in it. Ground contact time, step frequency. And what I see, well, in some of my athletes, that they take big steps and a low frequency. So they run at 160, 165 per minute. And then have big steps, so they're strong runners, but that costs a lot of energy. If you have big steps, you also have a big vertical oscillation. You have to go high to make those big steps, and that costs a lot. And if you try to increase the step frequency, so you go from 160, 165, try to do 175, maybe 180. That's very difficult for most of them to do little steps. In the beginning, it feels very difficult, and they feel very tired. But if you manage to do that very good and you get used to it, it will be more efficient. So your ground contact time will also be lower. And your step frequency goes up, and in the end, you're more economic.
Yeah, and I think especially for triathlon, when you're running after biking and swimming, makes a lot of sense to try to reduce the force that you're using, because you might not even be able to. For some runners, maybe it's the best way to run in a fresh run with yeah. longer steps, but then it might not be the case with the swim and the bike before.
No, then you're tired, and if you maybe you can do it in the first, well, let's say 10K, but then it's going down and down, and halfway or maybe 10K before the race, for the finish, you can't even run anymore.
Yeah. And coming back a little bit to the coaching methodology in general, so a couple of follow-ups on that. So first of all, how do you approach periodization?
Yeah, that's for every athlete different. It depends on what is the goal. But I'm not working with a periodization model like always 3 weeks up, 1 week down, or 4 weeks up, 1 week down. I always listen and read the comments of the athletes, how fresh they are. I also let them measure some data for the recovery. But I make a decision on an easy week, or maybe not an easy week, but easy days, on the freshness of the athlete. I have a plan where's a goal at the end. So but where the recovery periods are, I decide that just in the week or in the time being, how an athlete is going, because many things happen, especially in age group athletes. You get sick, you have to go travel for work, many things happen. So if the periodization plan says, well, we have now 3 weeks building up, and then the fourth week is recovery, but now my work schedule has changed, and that week of recovery I have a lot of time to train. Then you have to change everything, because, well, maybe then it's not an easy, it's a good week to rest, because we have a lot of time to invest in training.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
And what about in terms of the, when you do what kind of intensity, do you try to keep them in parallel, or do you focus on some kind of intensity earlier in the year and some other type when you get closer to the races? How do you do that?
Yeah, I don't start with just aerobic training in the beginning. Let's say we have a year, and then the first 3 months are just aerobic. No, as I mentioned in the beginning, I always have some intensity, high intensity interval training, but that's sometimes it's just, let's say, 10 times 30 seconds of a high intensity with 3 minutes break. But when we come to races, the race specific intervals will become more important, and will have more time in the total week load. Also, my biggest weeks, if you do a long distance triathlon, my biggest weeks is just 2 months before the race. Then it's the biggest month or weeks that the training load is. Many of the athletes always ask me, how many time do I need to reserve for training, and what's my biggest weeks? And I say, if they want to do a full Ironman, well, let's say the two, three months before the race, you have to be not that busy in your work schedule.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I had another question on the tip of my tongue, but it just disappeared there. That happens. Let's move on to the metabolic testing, which you mentioned earlier that you do a lot of. And can you discuss more details about how you do that and how you use metabolic testing in your coaching process?
Yeah. Well, I do the lab testing. And in my opinion, I do that once a year. And that's, in my opinion, it's enough, because as every athlete has a power meter in the bike and a power meter with the run, I get lots of data in the training process during the year. So the power testing keeps on going onwards every week, every month. But the lab testing is, for me, important to have a start meeting, a test. And there's also the health issue, because it's not just only the exercise test. It's also a blood test. It's also the medical checkup. It's an EKG. It's a lung function test. So I do everything to see if there are any health issues. And then the exercise test is to see how the performance profile of the athlete is. And now I'm trying to do some more of field testing. These days are coming up more mobile CPAP devices, you know, the VO2 Master. Now I'm also working with the Spirofit. It's from Germany, and the VO2 Master has an oxygen sensor. The Spirofit has an oxygen and a carbon dioxide sensor, so that's even better to do the field testing. And that helps me to see how the metabolic process in the field when they're running outdoors or cycling outdoors, what are they doing then, and how efficient are they? Because efficiency is one of the things that's really important in long distance triathlon. It's not the one that has the highest VO2 max. It's important, but efficiency. Well, if you have both have a high VO2 max, but one is much more efficient than the other, I'll put my money on the efficient one. And last year they published a very good study from Peter Christensen with Magnus Dietleff. They did very great field testing and race simulation tests. And that was before the build up to Challenge Roth world record. We'll put that in the show notes, but that's a really good example of a field testing and how much information you can get out of that.
Yeah, I'm writing that down. I'm going to put that in the show notes. I think that I did read that, and what is quite interesting is that he is very controlled on the bike. Like he's not working at a very high intensity, relatively speaking, at least based on that simulation. So that was interesting.
Yeah, and there you see. Well, it's still impressive because he pushes 320 watts and has a oxygen uptake of 4 liters. Then, so that's pretty efficient. And it's really nice to see that and to read that and to show it also to my guys. You see what he does. That's, well, let's say the benchmark. You have to do that. If you can do that, you can win. And it's not that simple, because you have to, yeah. But it's something where you can work to and see if you can get in the area of that.
Yeah. By the way, I want to mention for the listeners that are not familiar with CPET, so that's cardiopulmonary exercise testing.
Yeah,
is the acronym. About the VO2 Master, I thought that they had a new version that has the carbon dioxide sensor, but because I've heard of that for 3 years, that it's almost out. But maybe it's still almost out.
Yeah, I heard that also, but it's still not.
Well, okay,
it's still not in the market, and I know Gustav Eden and Christian Blumenfeld have worked with it, and I talked to Olaf Alexander Boo. He also said that. But well, if they have it, okay, they have worked with it, but it's still not it's not in the market now.
Yeah. So about how you set the targets for the training, then do you, because you do both, you have the field testing and you have the critical power in the bike and the run, critical speed on the swim, but you also had a lab testing when you start with an athlete or the start of the year. How do you it? And we already talked about some example sessions. So it sounds like you use critical power and critical speed a lot. Does the lab testing, does it inform the testing in the early stage of the year, or is it more to measure where you are, but not so much to set the targets for the training and use critical power for that?
The last one more. I know for every athlete, I know where he or she is at what point. So I know where the VT1, the ventilatory threshold 1 and 2, where they will happen somewhere, and I'm always on it. Well, in between the submaximal stages, you can see the amount of oxygen that they use, the metabolic energy. And I want to see how much metabolic energy they need to produce a certain amount of mechanical energy. And I hope that they get more efficient. So they need less oxygen to produce the same mechanical energy.
Yeah.
And that's something, well, I can only see in the lab. And also, if we have a field test, we can also see that. But you have to measure then with the cardiopulmonary exercise device.
Yeah. And what about athlete profiling? So we talked about the anaerobic, aerobic, sprinting, etc.
Yeah.
How, which data points, which metrics do you use to track that and to see what kind of profile an athlete is and how that changes?
Well, the critical power model I use, that's the most thing I use, because I now also work a lot with a double critical power model. So I have one that looks at the shorter time interval, so that's the 2, 5, and 10 minutes. So that's more like your aerobic anaerobic part. The longer it gets, and then we have the 20 and 40 minutes. Well, in 20 minutes maximum performance and 40 minutes maximum performance, the anaerobic part isn't that big anymore. So that's the aerobic part. And the professor from the University of Ghent, Charles Douwe, has built a quite nice model with that, and I use it now a lot to see where the critical power, and also they call it the super critical power. So we have a sort of critical power, and then where you, until that you have a sort of, let's say, a slow death. You burn a little bit of anaerobic energy, but you can maintain that in a sort of steady state. And if you go above the super critical power, then you go into a fast death, and then it will not maintain that long until your anaerobic tank is empty. And that's the simple thing to use. That is just, you have to have good power data. But if you have a lot of power data, and I have tables from, let's say, the last 90 days or 365 days and the top 10 of 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, etc. So I can see the decrease in power, fill in those in my model of critical power. And then I see, we're now at 330 watts critical power, and the time that they can hold on that is almost 30 minutes. And then I can follow up with the training sessions. If I do VO2 max, then I have to go to 120% of the 330. So that will be 400.
And do you use especially for the longer, the 20 and 40 minute, is that something, do you do actual 20 and 40 minute tests, or is it you take it from hard sessions?
Yeah, from hard session. Some people like to test, and it doesn't matter if it's 20 minutes or 40 minutes, they just really like to suffer. And they, well, I say, be my guest, do it. I like the numbers. If you can give them to me, that's okay. But most of the time, well, I just gather all data that that I have from them. And then it's from hard sessions. Maybe they did some shorter races where there's a good 20-minute block in it, maybe from a climb. So it's not that often that I prescribe the 20-minute test.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And then so with then coming back to the profiling question. So I guess you use W prime, D prime, or well, if you use Power on the Run, it's W prime anyway. How do you use that then to or what? Can you give some examples, some benchmarks for what you're looking for different types of performances, for Ironman or for mountain biking or other more punchy, explosive events?
Yeah, mountain biking, that I have some under 23 very talented guys and some pros also in the women's field. And mountain biking is a sport where the W prime is very important, in my opinion. You have to attack. You have to ride up the hills fast, and it goes down short time. So you have to recover also fast. So, well, let's say there's a high VO2 max and a high V lactate max. That's important. That's not very easy to have them both high. But then I try to see. Especially mountain bike races, can they keep up with the depends on the course, with the short climbs, or is it that a rider is better on the longer climbs, so a more steady state climb, than the punchy ones? The punchy ones are well stronger in the anaerobic part, and I try to have the critical power. Well, at a really good level, and for mountain biking, well, that goes to 5 watts per kilogram for males, even higher. And then anaerobic capacity, then we go to, well, about 30,000 joules. So that's a big anaerobic tank. And in my training sessions, I can calculate in a model, then if we do, let's say 40-20 intervals, and we go above the critical power for 300 watts higher for 40 seconds, you can calculate 40 seconds times 300, how much energy goes out of the anaerobic tank, and then you give 20 seconds recovery. And then you do that 4 times or 5 times or 6 times, see how far the athlete comes. You can see, well, if he can do that a lot of times with a good recovery, then the recovery is good and the anaerobic tank is also very big until it's empty.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really technical story like this, but well, many things, especially with the critical power model and the W prime, it is predictable.
Not yeah,
100%,
yeah.
But no. A lot.
The recovery is the slightly more difficult one, but if you have something like a pursuit race on the track or something like individual pursuit or something like that, then it's a very good model.
Yeah.
But still useful in many other events for sure.
Yeah.
Let's get into some age group specific questions. So the first and obvious one is, how do you approach age groupers that have that are limited in terms of their training time?
Yeah, and that are almost every age group athlete has limited time because he has work, family, other social things. So the thing that I ask them or tell them is make a proper schedule with the time available for training. So it's not what many, the most of them ask, how much training hours do I need? Well, I ask them back, how much training hours now in a week do you have, really? And not not the very late hours or early hours. Well, I can do that, and we would add something there and a little bit there. So you have to be realistic about the schedule. How many hours do you really have? And that is something where you have to do it. You have to do it with. If somebody only has 10 hours, you can say, well, I want to do an Ironman, a full Ironman, but I only have 10 hours. Okay, we can come an end, but there is a period that you have to do more. So maybe you have some weeks in your schedule then, especially in the 2 months or 3 months before, where you can do more. Maybe have some training camp, vacation. But that's the thing. 10 to 15 hours is okay. You can do a lot with that. Make good decisions about in which sports you invest the most of the time. So some people go 4 to 5 times swimming an hour, where 2 hours maybe would be enough. And the other 3 hours you can better invest in better cycling or running. And the other thing is, if they want to add some extra training hours, maybe in the late evening or in the early morning, it always is a danger then, because it if you do more training sessions, you also have to have more recovery hours. And if you do the training sessions late in the evening, well, that will decrease your recovery very much. It will not make you better then.
Especially if you do it late in the evening and early in the morning.
Exactly. Then they have to do late in the evening. You're laying in the bed and, oh, I can't get to sleep. Oh, I have to go to the pool tomorrow at 5:30. Oh. It doesn't work.
It's tricky. If you have 10 hours and let's say we're still far away from the races, and well, other than knowing what sports you maybe need to prioritize, what things do you do maybe differently than somebody who has like a pro athlete who has a lot of time? Do you do a bit more intensity, or what are there any other differences that are that you can generalize and say that you do?
It depends on what the athlete is coming from. Well, the swimming part, it's just the smallest part of a triathlon. So let's say maybe two times a week. So then we have 1 or 2 hours. And then it depends on, is the athlete a better runner or a better cyclist? Because if you are a very good runner and you have a personal best on the marathon of 2:48, and you have to develop more in cycling, well, then you have to put most of the hours into the cycling, because that's the things you have to develop. So that would be 5 to 6 hours, and maybe then 3 hours of running in this example.
Yeah. And what are the most common mistakes that you see age group athletes making their training?
Well, that is also with the recovery, cut in recovery. It's always that they the age groupers want to train more, but they don't think that if they train more, that they need more recovery hours, because I can rest at home or at my work. I have a job that I sit behind a computer. Then that's rest. Well, that's not the same as rest. So that's a mistake that they often make, because they only think about more training. If I do more training, then I'm going to be better, stronger, faster. But if you train if you go from 10 to 15 hours of training, well, probably you also have to add up 5 hours of extra recovery. It's not only the 5 hours of extra training. So you need 10 hours extra. So where do you get that?
I agree. And do you have specific tips for older age group athletes? So maybe 50 plus. And so anything that, any special considerations there?
Yeah, strength is very important getting older. So adding some, well, total body strength training, it doesn't have to be very hard, heavy, explosive, but train all your muscles as a 50 plus athlete. It's very important. If you maintain your muscle mass, that will help you to maintain also your athlete performance.
At what age do you start earlier to focus even on whole body strength? Do you start at 45, 40, 35?
Well, I think it's important for everybody. It's important for everybody, but well, if you get older, you lose muscle mass. And maybe if you have long distance triathletes in the age group of 50 plus, they're really good and they're really strong. So maybe they are not at risk, but still, getting older, your recovery is also getting worse. It takes, if you have a hard training session, it takes longer to recover from that than maybe 10 or 20 years ago. So that's something to keep in mind. And maybe you need some extra time to build your body muscles.
Yeah, makes sense. And this is an interesting one. I haven't talked about this in a while on the podcast, actually. But how do you think about, for new triathletes, a good progression through the sport and through the distances? Because I think some athletes come into triathlon with the only goal of doing an Ironman, and some of them want to do it the first year. And it's possible, but do you think it's advisable? Or what is your recommended progression through the distances?
Yeah. Well, this is more a kind of, let's go back 10, 15 years. There were also bucket list things, and then you had to run a marathon. And running a marathon is not that's fancy anymore. Nowadays, if you want to do a bucket list thing, you have to do an Ironman, and then you belong to the group. So that's the kind of thing that you hear. Maybe they hear it at the birthday party, then some guy or woman did the Ironman. You can do that too. And then they say, oh yeah, I'm going to do that. So I'm going to find a trainer coach and that had to help me to do a full Ironman next year. Yeah, I have also requests about that. Normally, it's not my favorite. I just want to help people that are in the sport because of their motivation. They like the sport. They like to swim, to bike, to run, and they want to improve that. And normally I say, well, start, if you ever have done a triathlon, start with an Olympic distance or maybe a sprint. Just do that and see if we get faster. And then we can do a half a triathlon. And maybe, well, in 1 or 2 years later, if you have done several triathlons, we can go to the full Ironman. In my opinion, that would be a better way.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I skipped one question. I'm going back to it here. What do you think about pacing strategy for age groupers? How, and especially maybe if you talk about self-coached age groupers, how should they know what paces, powers, heart rates that they can hold?
Well, if I look at pacing and I do the pacing, as I told you, in power, I assume the age groupers also know their functional threshold power or critical power for a full or let's say a half Ironman. If you're a good biker, you can try to maintain 90% of the critical power, functional threshold power. If you're not that good biker, maybe you can go between 85 and 90%. For a full distance, you go to 80%, and maybe if you're not that good biker, 70, 78-77%. So a little bit lower, conservative. And that would be a very good pace strategy. The heart rate is also very, well, it's more your external load or your internal load. And that says something about how the body reacts to everything. Also the temperature, the dehydration, etc. So maybe your pacing strategy is still good at your normal, at your wanted power, but as the temperature outside is very high, your heart rate is maybe going up too much, and that, well, it would not say that you have to go much slower, but it gives you a sign that something is more stressing your body more than usual. So probably it could be that you lost too much or you dehydrated, and that, you know, that affects your body and your heart rate. So get your hydration at a higher level, decrease a little bit your power and see what happens. So that's a little bit, and for the running, if you run with stride, you can have the same power ranges. So the 90% at half Ironman and 80% at full. But you can also do it at critical speed. But then if it's a hilly course, it will be very tricky.
And it's important to say that the percentages will be different if we talk about speed and critical speed compared to power, because and this also is the same for the interval training that we talked about, because while you may be able to do 120% of your critical power on the run, you're not going to do that with speed for anything longer than a very, very short interval. What about this is maybe the final question here on the age group coaching segment. Are there some things that you think are overrated and underrated? And this could be anything from products, training methods, beliefs, etc.
That's a nice question. Well, there are certainly things that are overrated, and it has to do something with, let's say, sports supplements. And I'm not saying that it doesn't work, but sometimes you hear athletes talk about they only take sports supplements and they take a lot of that, and that's the best, and then forget that they just have to eat. That's the basis. They have to eat well and good and enough. And they think the other way around, if I have enough supplements, then everything is okay. I don't have to worry about the rest because I have enough. I think if you eat good and enough, then maybe you can use some extra supplements, and there are proven supplements at all that work: caffeine and bicarbonate and creatine, vitamin D. There are maybe 10 or 20 more supplements, and every supplement tells you if you use this one, you go 5 or 10% faster, or recover faster. That's the overrated, I think, for most of them.
Yeah,
and maybe the same is for recovery tools. You get the boots and the ice baths and all those things. And what they forget is get good sleep, and enough sleep. That's the cheapest one. But this is a quick fix.
Yeah, for sure. And are there any things that you would say are underrated?
I talked about the efficiency. What I think is very important to be to have an efficient, very efficient athlete, and that's something that's not that often mentioned, because it's mostly looked at if a performance profile. What's your VO2 max? Well, it's important, okay, but it's not key. It's not the most important thing. I think in long distance triathlon and half distance triathlon, efficiency is much more important.
Yeah, definitely. And even with things like, this is an example that I've used quite sometimes, but in terms of getting the most out of your money that you spend as a triathlete, something like comparing like a few different pairs of shoes to see what is the most efficient pair for you, that can be a very, like, if you're going to spend money, that I think is quite a good way to spend money and potentially get quite a lot of minutes, because these shoes can have a big difference in terms of the efficiency in general, but there are individual differences as well. So to find whether the Adidas or the Nike or the Asics are best for you, that can be a good option. Same thing with some aerodynamic testing and usually or even a good bike fit compared to like buying some super expensive thing that will gain 2 watts on your bike, but having a good bike fit, and then maybe testing some things with the bike fit on the road to see if you go faster.
You're sitting a lot of hours on the bike, and if you don't sit comfortable, well, that you won't race fast.
Great. So let's move on to the next topic here. So you work with some pro triathletes, long distance triathletes. So the listeners will know Menno Kolhas and Tristan. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of his last name. Can you help me here?
Ole.
Okay, Tristan Ole. So you mentioned in our email conversation that you've worked a lot with them on their bike performance. So, and we saw that with Menno already, because he's been very prominent in the races last year and have great results. So can you talk about that process and what results you've had?
There's the famous torque training again. Menno is an athlete that I know him for a long time, because I've been sports doctor for the Triathlon Union already since, it was 2006, I think. So Menno started triathlon a long time ago. Did first Olympic distance triathlon and switched later a couple of years ago to long distance. And I know he's an incredible swim talent. He runs also incredibly fast. He's a big guy. He's 192 and about, let's say, 80 kilograms. So he has to also be a big, strong cyclist, I assumed. But every time in races in the beginning of this year, he got dropped, because he's there in the front with the swim, and then he got dropped on the bike. And he needed a medical certificate for the races in my practice. And I talked to him and I said, "What's happening there on the bike? Why can't you stay there? Why do you get dropped?" "Oh, yeah, I don't know. And I'm strong." We got in this discussion, and he also with his trainer Jordi, and they know each other a long time and do a lot of feeling. He knows very good feeling on the swim and a very good feeling on the run, but on the bike the feeling isn't not good developed enough to feel if it's hard enough or not. So that's he was thinking about that, and he came a couple of weeks later. He came back to me and asked me to help him. So it was about May 2024. And Frankfurt was on the race calendar in August, and that's the place where he had to qualify. So we had to work, and it had to be done there, and he should not lose too many time there. And then we started to do some torque training, and he did some torque training, but not, in my opinion, not high enough torque. So it was about 0.75, 0.8 newton meters per kilogram, which was about 400 watts. And now we upgraded it to 500 watts. and then seated in the saddle. And then we went on from 2 minutes to 3 minutes. And the hill wasn't high enough in the south of Holland. We didn't get up to 4 minutes, but 3 minutes was okay. And then we also worked more on the anaerobic tank. So the high intensity intervals, the VO2 max intervals, race specific intervals, because if there's a tech in the race, somebody goes to the front and attacks, he shouldn't be dropped too much. Well, Tristan is also a very good friend of him, and Tristan trains with me since 2022, so he was with me for a longer time, and he's a very good and stronger biker, but he's just as big and heavy as Menno, and he knows the training sessions, so his strength was his bike performance. And we did the same. So they did training sessions together. And so before Frankfurt, we did the last sessions there. And I think, well, now we did some testing in intervals. And I think, well, if you race now, you do your swim like before and be in the front. I'm confident that you won't be dropped. Well, he fell. He had a crash. I don't know where I was. It was 80 kilometers, I think, in Frankfurt. So he lost a little bit contact with the group, and then I was watching the race, and then you saw he didn't lose much at the group anymore. He was totally by himself, and he did it by himself. So he rode there. I think it was 310 average and 330 normalized, and that was the power that that was needed, and in that he was in a run place, maybe a little bit too much behind the front. Only top five would have a slot, but still, well, he had an incredible run. And managed to get fifth. So that was the first thing. Immediately success, because he had a Kona slot. And Tristan already had a Kona slot earlier this year. So now they can go both. They could go both to Kona. But then, after Frankfurt, he had a pretty rough recovery and kept on feeling some pain in his shin bone, tibia plateau, which after I think it was 3 weeks starting to feel the pain getting more and more, and there's it, is it pain or is it an injury? And there was my, well, I thought, well, this is not the simple pain anymore, this is more. So we had to do some an MRI, and there it was. They saw that there was a stress reaction there, so he couldn't run anymore. We had to skip running for 3 weeks. And I went with both guys. I went to Kona, and we went 3 weeks before the race. We went to Kona, and went that was the first day he ran outdoor again, 3 weeks before the race. So it was really tricky there. but we did a lot of cycling in the preparation. I discussed it also with his trainer. We can do two things. We don't go to Kona and say, well, it's over, we can't do it, or just try to make the best out of it. Focus on the swimming and focus on biking. And the swimming was the goal. Get the first out of the water. Well, he did that. And then biking, stay in the top group in Kona. Well, he did a lot of biking. He was strong, just as Tristan. And he kept on in the front in Kona and had almost the same power values, also 310, 330, I think. And then the run was just waiting and see and hoping that it would, that he would survive. Well, he did.
And what did he finish? He finished in the top, did he finish fourth, sixth, five, fifth? Okay, yeah.
Fifth, and Tristan was 22nd.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that is, it was both, for both it was the first time there.
Yeah. With Menno, because he has a T100 contract now, so would you say that that changes, will that change any of his training with the different, slightly different type of racing?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit different, and it's more suited for Menno, I think, because he's more a race animal. So he likes the speed and he likes the race, and long distance is just waiting until I come off the bike and then run for a half a marathon, maybe 30 kilometers, waiting, keep it easy, keep, and then if you have something, you can go. And that's, and the T100 is just go, start fast and then race, go. It's much more dynamic. So, and Menno likes that more. And Tristan is just the opposite, I think. He's just, he can wait, push, do his thing. He's more, well, let's say more a machine. You can program him, you can push 320 watts, and he does it.
Yeah, yeah. And what are, if there are any changes that you make in the training on the, especially on the bike specifically, for the T100, what kind of changes are they?
Well, the training now is back to Jordi. I'm now more as let's say an advisor, consultant at the background. So I see the data and I say, well, maybe a little bit more of this, maybe a little bit more of that. But now he needs to be. He don't has to have a very big aerobic engine now because it's big enough. He now needs more anaerobic capacity. So if somebody attacks, he must easily can answer that. And still, the torque training stays in because that the strength is very important. And if he is strong enough, he can answer all those. His anaerobic capacity will also be good.
Yeah, and I guess that's the anaerobic capacity is the one type of training that I didn't really ask for an example yet. So can you give an example of a session?
Yeah, that the 20 seconds, 30, 40, 20 seconds. So that's, and then if we talk about, well, in this case, if they have a critical power of 400 watts, they have to do 600 watts for 30 seconds. And then 30 seconds, that's easy pedaling, 200 watts. And then again, so 600 watts.
And how many times would you do that?
Well, so if it's easy, it's 5. And if it's hard, it's going to do 10.
Mm.
And then 3 or 4 series.
Yeah.
So it's a tough training.
Yeah. But do you think, is that something, because it's 150% of critical power if you go to 600 from 400?
Yeah.
Are all triathletes capable of that, or would you lower that to 130, 140 for some?
I try in the beginning also with every triathlete. We'll see if you manage this. And then we do, maybe do 3 or 4 times the 30 seconds and see if they manage it. And if they manage it, okay. And most of them, if they see the training session in their schedule and they read it and they think, he must be kidding.
This is for somebody else.
This is for somebody else. And then sometimes they at me, no, it's for you. Just try it. Just, okay. Okay, I'll try it. And they manage. So, sometimes they get near, but they don't manage it. So then I go a little bit lower until they manage. And then I see, well, okay, this is the level you manage. And then we go from 5 to 8 to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds pretty horrible, but I'm sure it's very effective. I just remembered a question that I lost earlier. So let's do that question, which is, when you have, of course, with age groupers, they are more limited on time. But with professional athletes, whether it's triathletes or cyclists or whatever, Would you consider yourself to focus more on the volume or on the intensity? How would you categorize your training in that vein?
Yeah. More on intensity, but if it's I also have long rides, long runs in it, and if I see, and I've planned a long ride for 4 hours, for 5 hours, maybe on a training camp 6 hours, they really have a hard time with that. Then I know, well, this part of it is not good enough. So we have to develop this, and maybe we do now a little bit less intensity work, just keep that level, and then we do some more long rides or long runs because it's not strong enough.
Yeah.
And some people, well, they don't have any problems with the long training sessions, and they like it really. Sometimes do trail runs of 50 or 60 kilometers with two fingers in their nose. And I said, well, this is okay. Eh? Well, you're good in this. So we have to increase the intensity, because I think you're not that good in this part.
Yeah. With Tristan, for example, not in the biggest weeks before an Ironman, but let's say in a normal week, how much volume would he normally do?
He did some training camps just back from Mallorca. Well, the hours is about 30 hours
okay,
a week.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Pretty high still. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's about, let's say, seven to 8 hours of swimming, approximately. Could be one less. Then we have, well, between 15 and 20 of cycling, and then 7 to 8 hours of running.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Let's skip to the reflective questions here. This will be pretty quick because we're coming up on time, but just some short answers to these. First, how do you learn and improve your craft?
Yeah, that's a good one, because I'm always eager to learn more. So I keep up with different research sources. I see the people that publish articles all about the exercise physiology, nutrition, recovery. I try to see what is published new, and pick up the things out of it. And I have a big folder in my Dropbox with all science articles, and I put them in it. And maybe I don't read them that day, but later in the week I will read them.
Yeah. And what is something that you're focusing on at the moment, or trying to learn about at the moment?
Yeah, that's the field metabolic testing.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm doing some testing with the Spirofit and the VO2 Master. So sometimes people look at me, what are you doing here? And then I run around my house or in the forest with a mask on, and just to see, well, how does it work good? Is it okay? Can I use it now already for my athletes? And the other thing is the critical power models, which I'm using.
Yeah. And what is the best or most influential book or books that you've read?
Yeah. I'm not a book reader that much, but I have a book that influenced me a lot, because that's the book of Training and Racing with the Power Meter from Hunter Allen and Andrew Coggan, and that's the beginning of, because I had a SRM Power Meter in 2010, I think. And I wanted to know much more about it, how it works and how to train with it. So that's a little bit the start of my training and coaching with power. And in 2013, I organized a power clinic here in the Netherlands and invited Hunter to my home. And he gave the clinic here. So from that time on, we have a close relationship. And it was really cool to have him here and learn a lot from him.
Yeah, excellent. And what is the best advice that you've ever received?
Yeah. Well, that's something that, you know, most people know where they're good in, good at, but it's more important maybe where you're not good at and know your weakness. And sometimes people should know more their weaknesses and maybe trust other people that they're better in that. And that's also in my profession as a doctor. Some doctors think they know everything about that, or all patients, but I think you can better listen to somebody who knows very much about a little bit, and maybe he's better than you. So know your weaknesses is very good, and ask for advice to somebody who knows a lot of that.
That's great. That's great advice. And yeah, that's it. Thank you so much, Guido. It was super fun and very insightful. Where can listeners follow you and find out more about yourself?
I have a website, my own website, and then it's just guidovroemen.com or .nl, whatever you want. I have a LinkedIn profile, also Guido Vroemen. Maybe it also would be nice. I also have a LinkedIn group that's Triathlon Science.
I think I might be in that group, even though I haven't logged into my LinkedIn in quite a few years.
It would be good to increase some good articles in that. And also I have an Instagram account, also Guido Vroemen.
I'll put everything in the show notes. Thank you so much, Guido. It was really great to talk to you, and hope to do it again another time.
Yes, thank you very much.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, where we'll have all of the links mentioned, including we talked about the extended critical power model, or I think Guido used the term double critical power model. There's an interesting article on that. It's not really, as far as I understand, something that has been discussed in terms of scientific publications or peer-reviewed research, but it is a very interesting reading nonetheless. So I have a link to that. And also, of course, the article we mentioned about Magnus Ditlev's race simulation. Also, just a reminder, if you haven't checked out how I write the episode descriptions, which you can see in your podcast app, wherever you listen to the podcast right now, or in the episode show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. I now put several recommended further listening episodes in there always. So those will be other episodes that I've done that have been either perhaps similar in some way, or similar types of guests, or even extensions of what was discussed. So going further into detail on some specific topic we discussed. So I have several of those as well. For example, and there is clearly a Dutch connection here, and also a cycling connection, I would say, but I interviewed Louis de la Haye some time ago, and that was a really good interview. He has coached athletes like Annemiek van Vleuten and Richard Murray, Rachel Klammer, Mike Ingma. So that's just one example. I put several other episodes. I won't mention them all. But whenever you finish an interview, you can always go and look at the related episodes that I put in there, and they're handpicked by me. It's not some random algorithm. And give them a listen if you're interested. If you started listening more recently, it will give you a great insight into the archives of the podcast and episodes that I think are genuinely worth listening to and that I would recommend. So yeah, hope you find that useful. Again, it will be in the episode description that you can find in Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to the podcast. Now, just quickly, a personal takeaway from this interview with Guido about torque training. I think that it seems to be a clear trend towards people doing more intensive torque training now than 5 to 10 years ago. And I think that's you see that in triathlon, you see it in cycling, and it's something that I see not just from interviews, but also in off-air discussions with coaches. I personally have also started using this. I do like to diversify a bit, so I tend to use a mix of both more intense torque interval sessions like the ones we discussed here, and also the more classic sub-threshold torque intervals. because I have seen them work in the past as well. But definitely, I think that since starting to use these more intense ones, not exactly as the way that that Guido uses them, but still something kind of similar with short 1 to 4 minute intervals, let's say, I think that that has been really useful for at least some athletes. So I think it's definitely worth giving it a try and see how you respond, and if you're interested to give it a shot. In the next episode of the podcast, we have a big name guest, 3-time Ironman world champion Craig Alexander will be on. So that's an exciting episode where we'll get training and performance insights from one of the legends of the sport. So stay tuned for that. Subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And also, if you can, share it with your friends, with your clubmates, whoever you know that is into triathlon or endurance sports, so that more people can find the podcast and hopefully get some helpful advice from it. And speaking of helpful advice, if you want to get even more helpful advice and you are a motivated athlete, you want to improve your performance as much as possible within the constraints of your family and professional life, then there is no better way to do that than working with a good coach. And I would, of course, recommend working with a scientific triathlon coach. Triathlon training can be quite complicated, especially when you have to combine that with work and family. And doing it on your own often leads to second-guessing yourself, making incorrect decisions in key moments, training being too biased towards what you're used to, or on the other hand, jumping from one thing to the next without enough consistency. But working with a scientific triathlon coach, you'll have clear guidance, structured plans, confidence in your approach, and you'll be very likely to achieve levels that you couldn't have achieved on your own. So if you're interested, visit scientifictriathlon.com and check out the information about coaching, or email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com and we can discuss your options. If coaching is not for you or it's out on your budget, we also offer customized plans, ready-made training plans, and one-off consultations. So there are different options to suit most people. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.